Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Vicki Hansen, globally renowned professor and researcher, president of ACM, and distinguished professor of computing at the Rochester Institute of Technology. Vicki, you just have an amazing, remarkable background. You have so many contributions. I want to thank you for sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
Oh, well, thanks for inviting me, Stephen. Looking forward to it.
Now, we're going to do a little bit of context setting here first. So, you know, before we get into your participation of this, you know, amazing AI summit co-organized by the United Nations Agency ITU and XPRIZE, let's mine some details of your life's journey, which I think is fascinating as well. So first of all, I just want to congratulate you on the tremendous success you've had in your career.
Thanks. By the way, I like the comment about mining the details of my life journey. That was clever. So I do want to thank you for this opportunity, and I want to thank you for all the work that you've been doing on behalf of the Global Summit. I know you've been getting a lot of different parties together on this, a lot of work, so thank you for all of your effort.
Well, Vicki, you know, as I mentioned, you're a leader and icon in many respects and so on so many different levels, but I had to start somewhere. So can you describe some of the milestones in your life from the age of four?
That's good. No one's ever asked me to go back to when I was four before. Four is actually an interesting turning point in my life. I'm assuming you're looking for like turning points or defining features in my life, something like that. The age of four is actually when I moved from London to the United States. I moved from, I was in London. I moved to Denver in particular. And this was an interesting time. I don't actually remember it well, but I do remember my mother telling me that as a four-year-old, I didn't really fit in all that well with the social culture in Denver between my Cockney accent and my desire to drink tea. So I guess that was quite the year for me. Probably more defining in terms of who I am now was my high school experience, though. And it's probably hard to capture sort of the sense of the place that it was back then and why it so much shaped me. But at the time, I was really part of the minority group in a very diverse student population at that high school. And I think that's really where it shaped a lot of my values. It was a very progressive environment. Social issues were important in the climate and the student experience. Very, very defining time. And then after high school, I decided that I wanted to go to college, which was a first in my family. I had an extended family of cousins, only one of which, a much older cousin, had gone to college. But I remember all the discussions with my parents about why I thought I should go to college, and my mother explaining why she thought I should become a hairdresser, for which I must say I have really no talent whatsoever. But I did get to go to college, and one of the things I'd like to say is that there's always a lot of talking about mentoring of women in STEM subjects and the importance of role models. While I think role models are important, I want to make the point that when I was an undergraduate, I worked in the research labs for a lot of male professors, and they couldn't have been more supportive. Working with them, it never occurred to me that I wouldn't be a success or that I wasn't a valued member of the team. And then I went on to graduate school, and my PhD advisor was Mike Posner at University of Oregon. And again, I don't think I could have found anyone more supportive. So these were males in my life who I clearly considered mentors and very, very helpful. And I think one of the things that we need to do for women in computing is to get to more of an understanding of the vital role that men play in developing careers of the women. Let's see. So another maybe defining point in my life was my 25-year career at IBM Research. And I just want to say a couple things about that because I was proud of some of the things that I did there. It gives you a sense of the sign of the times. I was a leader of the team that developed the first K-12 internet system for schools. So this was a time when the schools didn't yet have an internet. What they had was a phone line going into the schools, and we had that phone line go into a server, and from that server, all the students and teachers were able to get an email account and get a news feed. And at that time, what we were able to give them was Gopher, the World Wide Web hadn't even come into popularity at the time. So this is something that became an IBM product and was sold in the United States and Canada for many years. And yes, the World Wide Web caught on, and we added the World Wide Web. But the thing that we were proud of there was really that we got the service going, got the Internet into the schools way back at the very beginning of when the Internet was starting to become popular, or at least being able to be used in education settings. And another project I was very proud of at IBM was one that I worked on with a woman named Carol Padden, who is at the University of California, San Diego. Together, we developed the first ASL English bilingual program for deaf students. So ASL is American Sign Language. And the primary goal of our project was literacy instruction. Our software was using the idea that many of the deaf students had ASL as a first language. They were in the process of learning English as a second language, and we were using ASL to support their learning of reading and writing. So this was something that, again, was used for schools for deaf children in the United States and Canada for many years until that technology we were using became outdated. And the last project I want to just mention here quickly was something that I worked on a little bit more recently. This was when I was leading the accessibility research team at IBM. Headquarters came to us, and they were developing a education program for middle school students to teach them about saving the environment, and they wanted to make sure that this project was fully accessible. Well, this project was done in a 3D virtual world, and at the time we did it, nobody had any idea how to make a 3D virtual environment accessible. And my team had the responsibility and succeeded in making this educational opportunity fully accessible to students who had vision and hearing loss, as well as motor difficulties and literacy issues. So probably the last thing I'll say in terms of like milestones or what made me who I am is that my life as an academic started relatively late. As I said, I was in IBM research for 25 years. And at some point after that, I was offered a job at a university in Scotland, which was great fun. And I remember arriving in Scotland to start to teach, and I was facing both a new culture and a completely new work environment since I'd never taught before. I was based in Scotland for nearly 6 years, and there I was leading teams doing research on accessibility and aging. While culturally, the U.S. and Scotland aren't all that far apart compared to differences between some nations, but the experience did give me a sense of different international perspectives on issues, and it's this kind of experience that certainly influenced how I approach ACM's global activities now.
So I can see some of the roots of the Vicky that I've come to admire so much as president of the ACM, sort of that early sort of international sort of broad perspective, because you came from the UK into the US and into an environment of different kinds of thinking and progressive environments, and then working in accessibility and so on, and having access to that within the IBM team and research, and then going back to Scotland again and again, seeing that sort of international perspective. Now I can see all the pieces.
Okay. Yeah.
Were there any additional triggers that made you interested in accessibility and inclusion?
Yeah. You know, people ask me this question a lot, and usually there's the expectation that I'm going to say something about I had a family member with a disability, but this wasn't the case. I came at it really from a research perspective. I was interested in issues of language and learning, and I applied for a postdoc at the Salk Institute for Biological Studies, and I was successful. And there I worked in the laboratory on language and cognition. And at that time, the researchers at the institute, there was Jonas Salk and Francis Crick and the people doing all of that kind of biological work, but there were also linguists there and neuroscientists, and this group of people was beginning to learn about language characteristics of American Sign Language, ASL, that I mentioned earlier. And so this was just an amazing time to be there. We were making discoveries about what language was, what it meant to be human in terms of having a language. And I was there for the emergence of pride in the culture of the deaf community, which has ASL as its central core. So clearly an exciting time. My views on a lot of things were shaped at that time, particularly because I became aware of issues about disability and how culturally defined many of them are through the environments, particularly environments that aren't inclusive. And so this was really the roots of my passion for doing work in accessibility and inclusive design. The idea being that as technologists, we need to consider creating software and systems that are usable by everyone. And if we don't, we're really creating a situation in which we're disabling people. So if properly designed, we can avoid many of the situations that create barriers for people in using technology.
You know, just again, fascinating. And I know you did an ACM Learning Center webinar, which was very, very popular with Eve Anderson. And
it's okay.
On accessibility. And I know we're planning another one. So I hope you and Eve can get together to do another one.
Oh, good. Well, I was only the moderator, so Eve did the work in giving the talk, and she was great. I was happy to be the moderator for that. It was very interesting.
Okay, I'm going to put you on the spot here, Vicky. Maybe we can reverse the roles.
I will certainly consider that, yes. Okay. No, I did enjoy it, and I did say that I'd be interested in doing another one of those, so yeah.
Now, let's get into the ACM, because we sort of touched on it already, and so can you share your stories behind your journey with the ACM, leading to be this president and it's such a pioneering president, I would say, in many respects, in your inclusion program and accessibility program and much, much more. So,
yeah, I think I do come from a different background than many of the presidents in the past. And it will be interesting to see what changes come about as a result of that. But anyway, how did I get there? That's the question. So I have been involved with ACM in many roles for many years. And this all started so simply. I was going to go to a conference, and I met the person who was the conference chair. And I just happened to say something like, well, if you need any help in organizing, just let me know. I'm willing to help. And she called about a week later. She needed some help. Next thing I know, they were having me run for office, and then I was elected chair of the SIG. So this was the special interest group on accessible computing, and that just started it all. It mushroomed. I started doing the volunteering really because my view is that professionally I need people to read my papers and my grant proposals if I'm going to get publications, if I'm going to get funded grants, that kind of thing. So if I'm relying on other people to do all this work for me, I felt that I had to give back and I had to do my fair share of reading other people's papers and grant proposals and stuff like that, working on conference committees. I've probably done a little bit more than my share over the years, more things than I probably should have done. But some of the other things that I've done for ACM, I have been involved in a number of volunteer positions, not only for the SIG on Accessible Computing, but also for SIG CHI, the SIG on HCI, Human Computer Interaction. I was vice president at large for SIG CHI. I've also been involved with ACM's publications. I was the editor-in-chief of the ACM Transactions on Accessible Computing. I served on a number of program and organizing conference committees for various SIGs, and eventually I was elected chair of ACM's SIG Governing Board, something a little different than ACM, but part of the whole volunteer structure and what I bring to ACM. When I was living in Scotland, I was elected fellow of the Royal Society of Edinburgh, and I became involved in activities with them, volunteering for them in different positions that have also fed into my experiences as a volunteer and knowledge of, you know, societies in general and how they work. Being chair of the SIG Governing Board, which I mentioned a minute ago, made me a member of the ACM Executive Committee. And from there, I was elected ACM Secretary, Treasurer, Vice President, and now President. So, you know, many different roles all to get to the role of president. But I just want to make a point about that. So I did all this volunteering, and I felt like I was as prepared as anyone could be to assume the role of president, but I still find that I'm constantly amazed at the new things I learn about the scope of ACM activities. I hadn't been involved, for example, with practitioners, and I've been incredibly impressed with what you're doing, Stephen, along with Terry Cota, to serve the practitioner community. I've also not been involved, for example, with ACM's education committee, and I'm constantly amazed at the extent of the work that they've done. It's simply amazing. So, yeah, my journey to president has been one that relied primarily on research activities within ACM, but there's many other paths to be taken to ACM leadership, too.
Yeah, I'm thinking you reflect an inflection point in the history of the ACM because of just the broad perspective that you bring, and I think it's a very positive and progressive kind of vision that will help to serve the organization very well. In line with that, how would you describe the ACM, and how is the ACM making a difference?
Okay. I do get asked to give short summaries about what ACM does from time to time, so I tend to have some standard things that I say, but I'll try and say a little bit more about it here. The basic idea is that ACM is the world's oldest and largest society for computing researchers and practitioners, and critically, it's a volunteer-driven society, so that the initiatives from ACM are only made possible because of the volunteer efforts of members such as you. I tend to be a particularly high-visibility volunteer, but there's a lot of ACM volunteers that give hours and hours of their time to make the organization successful. And another point I'd like to make is that even though ACM is headquartered in New York City, it really serves a global community, and we currently reach about 3 million professionals and students worldwide through our various technical, scientific, and education activities. And at this point in time, about half of ACM members live outside of North America, so we really are reflecting very global views of the computing field. And in terms of your question about how is ACM making a difference, this is really varied, again, given the diversity of our membership. But I think the main strength or contribution of ACM is through its technical leadership. So for researchers, for example, there's ACM conferences and research publications. ACM sponsors about 200 conferences around the world each year, and it collaborates on a lot more. These proceedings go into the digital library, where there's also ACM transactions journals. But the digital library has many other things, too. The communications of ACM magazine that serves a very wide readership. And from the practitioner board, you know about the webinar series that you can find there, including a recent webinar related to the upcoming summit that was a panel discussion on ethical challenges with AI. From an education standpoint, ACM serves the community through its curriculum efforts and the Education Board. So there was the CS 2013 curriculum, which provides an integration of topics essential for computing education. And they look at technical issues such as algorithms and data structures, but they also look at social issues and ethics, all as part of the CS 2013 curriculum. And then we have ACM's policy efforts. One of the ones that's relevant for the upcoming summit was the recent statement on algorithmic transparency. So this statement involves seven principles designed to address potential algorithmic bias. And I can't leave the section here without talking about ACM's upcoming Turing 50th celebration. With this, ACM is going to be celebrating 50 years of having had the Turing Award. As you know, this Turing Award is bestowed on people who are really visionary people in computing. Most people by now, I think, have heard that Sir Tim Berners-Lee was just announced last week as the most recent Turing laureate, and he's obviously being honored for inventing the World Wide Web. At the 50th celebration, which will take place in late June, there'll be a 1.5-day event, and many of the past and current laureates will be there, and we'll be looking at key achievements of computing, and there'll be discussions of where the field is heading. There's going to be panels on a number of topics, and particularly relevant to discussions for the Global Summit, will be panels on deep neural networks, augmented reality, privacy and security, and challenges in ethics and computing. And last thing, I just want to say that the registration for this event is free, but the event filled up within really minutes of when registration was announced, and there's already a huge waiting list. So if people can't attend the event in person, I just want to let everyone know that the event will be live streamed, and then the videos of the event will later be made available through ACM's digital library.
I mean, it just the ACM has such an impactful imprint on the past, present, and future, sort of reverberating and so many domains and so many levels. And you as president are leading the ACM. So I thank you for all your contributions with the ACM and continuing contributions with the ACM. We're going to switch gears now, and that is we're going to discuss this inaugural Artificial Intelligence for Good Global Summit, which is organized by a UN agency called the ITU, which is the agency responsible for technology and standards in technology, and then XPRIZE. And this is in partnership with more than 10 UN agencies as well. And the event is a series of annual conferences or summits on AI, which will bring representatives from government, industry, UN agencies, civil society, AI research communities to explore the latest developments in AI and their implications on a broad range of areas. It's just perhaps in every area that you can think of, together with regulation, ethics, security, and privacy. And in addition, I would say the foundation, the heart of this summit will be these breakout, or what we call breakthrough sessions. We'll have participants collaborate, propose strategies for the development of AI applications and systems to make essentially the world a better place. And that's going to be ongoing work. Now, what triggered your interest in participating in the AI for Good Global Summit? And this is from the perspective as a researcher, one, at a personal level, and then as ACM president.
Well, this sounds like a very exciting event. How could I not be excited about attending this? I was thrilled to be invited. But to answer your question, let me take those three levels sort of in reverse. I'll talk about ACM, then personal and researcher. As ACM president, I'm always interested in getting a chance to discuss ACM and its activities in front of a new audience, people who may not know about it, or people who may not know about it in key contexts. So in this respect, the Global Summit's a great way to get out the word. For example, ACM has a special interest group in AI, and together with AAAI, ACM SIG AI is discussing a workshop on AI and ethics, something not yet announced, but they're working to form that event. But anyway, the idea of participating is a great way to think about how ACM might play a role in contributing to the summit goals going forward. Okay. On a personal level, I was immediately drawn to the idea of the Global Summit with the topic name of social good. I mean, really, how could I not want to participate in something that would contribute to social good? As I mentioned, my own background's in HCI, and just as sort of a long way of answering this question, each year I teach a course on current topics in HCI for graduate students here. And this is really just a chance for me to have fun as a teacher. We read current research papers, and we all discuss them in class. And the research papers every year are on topics of interest to me, and I get to see students' reactions to these topics. And actually, I get to really learn from the students about new ways of thinking about these topics. This semester, for example, we're reading papers on HCI for good, disaster relief, disability, ICT for D, and health applications. So all of these are topics near and dear to my heart that I have, you know, long been assigning in my class. And these are all topics that will be brought up at the Global Summit. So I'm really, really interested in being there to learn more about it. And this idea of learning is why I wanted to be there as a researcher, too. The topics are vitally important, really, for our whole planet. And I'm interested in seeing all the different perspectives that people bring. You know, in starting to ask this question, you listed all the different stakeholders that were going to be there. And I'm really excited to hear what each of the different ones brings. And I'm really just going there because I want to learn.
You know, I guess it's an opportunity, too, to shape history because it's the inaugural summit and then it's ongoing. And having you as the president of the ACM, and particularly with your background, I can see so much value that you'll bring to the summit. So thank you again for agreeing to participate. Now, from your perspective, again, what would you see as some of the top program areas of interest? And maybe you've already mentioned this, but maybe you want to explore it further. And then do you have any stories behind your choices?
Stories. I don't know how many stories I have, but I have looked at the program, and, really most of the topics, the program topics are really of interest to me. But really coming at this summit from an HCI lens, I might have a bit of a slightly different perspective than some people. I'm really interested in how humans and machines are going to be collaborating for a better future for all of us. So the first thing, one of the programmatic threads is on ethics, and I'm clearly interested in ethics. I find this really crucial to what we are going to be doing going forward. Clearly, we're moving at a rapid clip in terms of technology development, more rapid than we can really understand or plan for in some very real sense. So what can we really see about the future here? Certainly the people who developed the Internet and the World Wide Web didn't plan for some of the ways in which these technologies are currently being used. They built in flexibility, which is great, but with that flexibility comes the ability to use the tools in ways both good and bad. What can we do to help shape the primary outcomes as being good, I guess is a question I have for the ethics. And then, let's see, another programmatic thread has to do with humans and machines, which I said I'm particularly interested in. And I'm interested in the idea of augmenting human abilities, which I think you would expect, you know, for those of us who work in accessibility, this is clearly important. As part of this, I'm really intrigued by the future with assistive robots for care situations. So one of my nerdy stories. In my own life, I've been lobbying for several years for this. I finally got a Roomba robot as a gift, so now my floors can get vacuumed. I gather the Roomba came out in 2002, so I'm clearly not an early adopter of this technology, but I'm a very happy adopter of this robot in my home. It's a great assistive robot, but it's not very personal or social, right? I don't really interact with it. I just press on the button, and it goes and vacuums. What the field's looking for now is much more personalized and social robots that can learn. And they don't just learn how to do tasks, but they learn how to interact with people. It's an ongoing process. And so I look at this, and if I were incapacitated, I wonder, would I want a robot taking care of me? One of the things people look at is potential trade-offs. So people are probably more likely to say they would be interested in being taken care of by a robot if it meant they could stay in their homes rather than having to go to some kind of care facility, right? But those trade-offs, the curves on those trade-offs are going to be influenced by how social and how acceptable those robots really are going to be. So I'm interested in looking at the development of social robots and what kind of skills are they going to have to really be accepted in assistive care situations. I guess the third program thing I'm looking at for attending is promoting healthier citizens. So there is obvious potential for us as people to become more informed about our own health. Many people use these activity tracker things, and you can work and sensors, so you can work on your own health management. But naturally, people are really concerned about what happens with that data. People generally are in favor of data aggregation for helping medical research and trying to combat some disease. But people are really worried about giving their own personal information to anyone, even their doctors, for some kind of an analysis. This is something, I guess, getting back to ethics, where we're going to have to instill in some trust. Because at this point in time, there's issues of how much people really understand how their data is being used, but there are concerns about it. And in particular, people are very concerned about generating data that might be given particularly to governments and insurance companies. You know, they would generally say they're willing to give it to their doctors for their own health care. But if that in turn means it's going to be given out to insurance companies or governments, they're going to be less likely to get on board with anything that will generate data about themselves. So something to think about, again, probably back to ethics. As a fourth program topic, I'm interested in the idea of promoting equality, as you might suspect from what I've said before. My interest in promoting equality really went back to the idea of benefiting people in disadvantaged regions of the world. What can we learn from analyzing large data sets that could improve people's lives? A couple years ago, I heard a great example about research that was going on in Microsoft where they were mining data from openly available sources that to model floods. And this kind of effort could greatly help in emergency preparedness for disaster relief. And it could also help in planning for weather and other conditions in parts of the world that are so critically dependent on the environment for the very survival of the population there. And I guess the final example from the program I wanted to mention has to do with education. So I'm really concerned about education. There's a couple of separate issues here. I mean, there's the online learning, which is obviously booming these days. And we're developing the ability to have more personalized online education, which is opening up educational abilities for people in many, many parts of the world who didn't necessarily have access before. But a second part of the education involves around issues of what's going to be needed in the future and how do we educate students to participate in a world that's going to be greatly changed by the emergence of machines that do jobs not just in manufacturing, but do jobs that, like being a lawyer that or judge that traditionally required some kind of judgment, right? What skills are going to be valued and needed in the future? And how do people and machines work together when machines are really doing a lot of the work that people used to do? Or even, I guess there's the question of, do people continue to work with the machines? What are people going to do in the future? So scientists are now talking about the changing workforce and jobs and what's going to happen with them. But there does need to be the discussion of educating students for the long run, not just for the next few years, but really for a future where the whole vision of jobs is going to be completely different than what it is now, and something that we don't even really understand now. How do we plan for something that we can't completely know what's going to happen?
You know, some interesting choices, and I guess it brings up this idea of unintended consequences. You know, it's almost like the CRISPR-Cas9 or this CRISPR-CPF1 sort of new gene editing system that's come out, sort of maybe supplanting the Cas9 part. But what are the implications? What are the unintended consequences? And sometimes I think that in the future, we're going to have something called, I name it CASL, C-A-S-L, and that is we're going to have classic human beings, we're going to have augmented or hybrid human beings, and we're going to have synthetic life, all coexisting at the same time. And what are the implications of all three coexisting at the same time? That's another topic.
That sounds like sort of the science fiction things you read, but you're really envisioning this happening, right?
Yeah, and what happens when you have three coexisting? Yeah. What is that going to do to society? Anyways, some of the questions that I'm part of some private think tanks, and we were thinking about these questions. We also have these sustainable development goals, these sort of overarching goals of the United Nations that are going to obviously to make the world a better place and having all the countries buy in. Which ones do, sort of resonate with you, you know, that you find most compelling?
Yeah, it's really hard not to get behind all of them, in fact. But I'm just going to really pick on one in terms of the one on trying to reduce inequalities. And I mention this because in the kinds of work that I do with HDI and accessibility, we're often talking about the idea of a digital divide, and this digital divide has traditionally been along topics of economics, literacy, age, geography, and disability, those kinds of things. So it's largely related to access to devices, networks, and information presentation, usability of all of this, and trying to make it fair for all. But the question with AI, I guess, is will these digital divides shrink, or is AI really going to broaden it? So, again, will AI be in some places and not in others? And so some people are going to benefit a huge amount from AI while others are continuing to get more and more left behind. I think it's only through concerted efforts to keep it in everyone's mind about designing for all the whole idea of inclusion that we will be able to keep from making even larger digital divides than what we've got now. You were talking about unintended consequences just a minute ago. We all know that there have been the stories about algorithms being gender biased or recent examples from law enforcement, you know, they're biased in ways against some ethnic groups. We really need constant vigilance, constant thought about this in order to keep things from not having these inherent biases or leaving out some people who could really benefit.
Yeah, it's interesting. These are some of the internal discussions we're having. I'm on the steering committee for this AI for Good Global
right.
Summit, and these are the internal discussions we're having as well in terms of the content and, you know, what are some of the issues and controversies that are out there and how do we address them in a way that's meaningful and that will produce strategies and proposals that will make for better outcomes in the future and that we could continue to work on. So
it's
interesting what you're bringing up. Now we're going to sort of leave this area and go in sort of a more last section of this interview, so sort of more broader questions. You're exposed to so much. You are a legend, in essence, this global pioneer. You're one of the seminal kind of leaders in the planet for all the work you've done and continue to do. With so many opportunities and so many ways that you've been able to succeed and implement and execute, what continues to excite you?
You probably want a technical or a research answer there. You know, the first thing that comes to mind when you ask me that question is the thing that most excited me in the last few years was a trip I had to South Africa, and being in this open top Jeep situated in the center of a pride of lions. I don't know why I found that restful. Somehow I did. I felt really at peace there. I don't know. I love that. I guess I love new experiences in general, but I don't know. Somehow I found myself there. You talked a minute ago about the UN goals for sustainability, and thinking about that in terms of one of them has to do with preserving wildlife and, just sitting out on the middle of nowhere with just the lions and the other animals around me. That's what, I don't know, that's the thing I found most exciting for a long time. I have to say that I also, on a more serious note, I guess, I also enjoy all my ACM travels, and I'm getting to meet so many new people, experience different cultures, and meet students with their excitement going forward. So those kinds of things are very exciting for me too.
I guess that brings up a question. You have all of your ACM assignments and duties and travel together with your teaching and research activities, plus all these other activities like this AI for Global Summit. How do you make the time? How do you get it all fit?
How do I make the time, huh? It's hard. There's no doubt about it.
Touched on this already. You know, you're traveling extensively, you're speaking, you're working so much with the ACM. You must have some interesting stories to share, maybe something amusing or unexpected and so on.
My funniest ACM story, actually, was a couple years ago when I was at the Heidelberg Laureate Forum. For people who haven't heard about this, this is an amazing event. Every year it brings together laureates from the field of computing and mathematics. So from computing, we have the Turing laureates, and we have now the ACM prize winners. And for mathematics, the Fields medalists come, Abel laureates, and Nevelina laureates. So So it's an amazing event with these luminaries in computing and mathematics, along with 200 students who, you know, students of the future kind of a thing. And the meeting lasts for about 5 days. There's talks and there's one-on-one interactions with the students. So my particular story, I'll never live this down, at the Heidelberg Laureate Forum. A couple years ago, I was asked to be a session chair for a session. The session had a great lineup. First, Vint Cerf was talking, and then there was the 2010 Fields medalist, Go Bao Chao from Vietnam, and the third speaker was Leslie Lamport, who was the most recent Turing recipient at the time. Vint talked. All went well. The Fields medalist stepped up to the podium, and I was just getting ready to start my talk about him. And in sort of classic fashion, the AV system died. You know, you saw the blue screen of death and then the DOS reboot screen. And so I'm left up there on stage with everybody looking at me, and I just made some comment about, I wish I had taken singing and dancing lessons when I was a kid. And fortunately for everyone, I didn't burst into song. That would have been truly horrible. But I did this little soft-shoe dance on stage, and I can't tell you how many people still come up to me and remember my dancing on stage while the AV crew tried to get the thing started again. Anyway, that's my funniest ACM story. Anyway, on a more serious note, I just wanted to say something about ACM presidency does take time, and I volunteered myself, so my decisions for the time, you know, I made that choice. But I do want to give a shout-out to my husband, who has to put up with this, and to my two daughters. He realized that they do get a lot less of me because of the extensive speaking, travel, and work opportunities that you mentioned. So I want to thank them, but I do want to say that the thing that most affected me through all of this is each of them independently saying to me that they were proud of me. And just as a fun fact, I'd like to say that my older daughter just recently got her PhD in computing. She's also in HCI. And in the last few months, we started collaborating on research. So look out for the future research contributions from this mother-daughter team.
Wow, how cool is that?
I know. I'm very excited. Yeah, I can't wait for these joint publications to come out. Yeah.
And your soft shoe dancing kind of thing. I was just smiling.
Well, I'm glad the AV wasn't working, so that's not on video. So only the people there can talk about
it. Yeah, I was thinking maybe somebody caught it through their phone or something, but anyways. You know, this is sort of the last question, and it's kind of, you know, has some flexibility, but if you were conducting this interview, what couple of questions would you have asked, and then what would be your answers?
Okay. So I guess one thing that I get asked a lot is what I hope to accomplish as ACM president. And the main answer to that is that I'm looking towards the future of ACM. At the moment, you know, ACM is in a great position. We are technical leaders. All indicators are things are going well. One thing, though, I've noticed is that while, you know, the current members and leaders helped make computing what it is and have shaped directions for a period of time, what we aren't getting is, say, the millennials to really step up and volunteer and become members in the same way. So what I'm really working on is initiatives to get those next generation of computing people involved in ACM, so millennials, Generation Z even. We recently announced the ACM Future of Computing Academy, and this is designed for gathering together some of the great millennial Generation Z thinkers in the field of computing and getting them together and having them brainstorm ideas for what are good ways of getting the next generations of computing professionals together. How can ACM work to network, to address their careers, given that current careers are very different than the way careers were structured, you know, 30, 40 years ago. So right now, we got many, many applications for people to be involved in this. Decisions about who is being selected for membership are ongoing at the moment. It's not going to be announced. But that's something that I'm really excited about in terms of what I hope to accomplish as president, just get more input from those future generations. Also involved in, you know, the evolution of the digital library. There'll be more talk about that. Diversity, inclusion, and really a lot of attention to the goals and national needs of our global members. And just kind of as a last thing, I'm also usually asked about being a woman in a STEM field, some variant on a question about being a woman in computing. And so in this respect, it's worth, you know, I mean, people know that I was elected president, but it's worth mentioning that I wasn't the only woman elected in ACM's elections last year. The vice president for ACM, Sherry Pancake, is a woman. The secretary treasurer is Elizabeth Churchill. So the entire elected executive committee was female. And in addition to that, on council, there was a majority of women elected. So this was particularly interesting given that the voting membership of ACM is over 80% male. And to me, this indicates an inclusiveness, at least in thinking about women and women in computing. And I don't want to say that the problems of women in computing are solved by any means, because a small number of us have been successful. But I do think that it does represent a potential openness and maybe a change in the way things are thinking. So really just some reason for optimism in the future. And I'll give you just one last fun story, since you've asked for stories, and I haven't been able to think of too many of them. Just a personal fun fact. A couple years ago, there was a project done by CRAW and the Anita Borg Institute to try and honor the contributions of women in computing. And what the project ended up doing was creating a set of playing cards called the Notable Women of Computing playing cards. And the idea was that these decks of cards could be given out in classes, and the students would play games with them and learn about the different contributions of women in the field. So 54 women were selected for inclusion in this project. They were selected based on various honors in the field, such as having won the Turing Award or being given high-level awards by CRAW or the Anita Borg Institute. And I was thrilled to be selected, and I am the ace of clubs in this playing card deck. I have no idea how I was selected to be the ace of clubs, if that's supposed to mean something. But anyway, Ace of Clubs now has a special place in my heart.
Ah, that's an indelible imprint on our audience's minds.
Thank you. You can go online and see these cards. You can print them out for yourself. I don't know if you can buy them anymore, but yeah, they're still there.
Oh, that's a fact. I ask our audience to do that.
It was part of the Kickstarter program, yeah.
Okay. I mean, that's just a great way to end. And Vicky, I know your schedule is demanding, and we're so fortunate that you came in to do this interview. And thank
I'm happy
you
for, to do it.
And thank you for sharing so many of your deep experiences with our audience. It's just, and some remarkable stories as well. And your participation at this historical AI summit. So thank you again.
Thanks. I am really looking forward to the summit. Thank you.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Vicky Hansen, globally renowned professor and researcher, President of the ACM, and Distinguished Professor of Computing at the Rochester Institute of Technology.